This is Audible.
A dark island shrouded in evil. That is the mysterious abode of the unscrupulous General Zaroff, the only man in the world who has hunted the most dangerous game. Today on the Classic Tales Podcast. Welcome to the Classic Tales Podcast. I felt it only proper that we start the new year with a tale that has received more requests than any other story. Richard Connell's The Most Dangerous Game. First published on January 19, 1924 in Collier's Magazine, The Most Dangerous Game won the O. Henry Memorial Prize. It would become Richard Connell's most famous story and considered one of the greatest short stories in English literature. Richard Connell was born in Poughkeepsie, New York in 1893. While his father was editor of the Poughkeepsie News Press, Richard began his writing career. He was 10, and for every baseball game he covered, he got 10 cents. Eventually, he rose to become editor of the paper when he was 18. He went to Harvard, where he became editor of the Harvard Lampoon and the Crimson. While writing for the Crimson, he berated a New York newspaper editor who didn't take criticism very well. The man sued the Harvard newspaper for libel. Connell graduated from Harvard in 1915 and went to work for the newspaper editor that had sued over his editorial. Connell claims to have written over 300 short stories. After touring the world for many years, he finally settled in California, where he wrote screenplays for silent films. In 1932, The Most Dangerous Game was made into a film, using the same sets and much of the cast of King Kong, Willis O'Brien's stop-motion masterpiece. And now, The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell.
"Off there to the right, somewhere, is a large island," said Whitney. "It's rather a mystery."
"What island is it?" Rainsford asked.
"The old charts call it Ship Trap Island," Whitney replied. "A suggestive name, isn't it? Sailors have a curious dread of the place. I don't know why. Some superstition."
"Can't see it," remarked Rainsford, trying to peer through the dank tropical night that was palpable as it pressed its thick, warm blackness in upon the yacht.
"You've good eyes," said Whitney with a laugh, "and I've seen you pick off a moose moving in the brown fall bush at 400 yards, but even you can't see 4 miles or so through a moonless Caribbean night."
"Not 4 yards," admitted Rainsford. "Ugh, it's like moist black velvet."
"It'll be light enough in Rio," promised Whitney. "We should make it in a few days. I hope the Jaguar guns have come from Purdy's. We should have some good hunting up the Amazon. Great sport, hunting."
"And the best sport in the world," agreed Rainsford.
"For the hunter," amended Whitney. "Not for the Jaguar."
"Don't talk rot, Whitney," said Rainsford. "You're a big game hunter, not a philosopher. Who cares how a Jaguar feels?"
"Perhaps the Jaguar does," observed Whitney. "Ah, they've no understanding."
"Even so,
I rather think they understand one thing. Fear. The fear of pain and the fear of death."
"Nonsense," laughed Rainsford. "This hot weather is making you soft, Whitney. Be a realist. The world is made up of two classes, the hunters and the huntees. Luckily, you and I are hunters. Don't you think we've passed that island yet?"
"I can't tell in the dark. I hope so."
"Why?" asked Rainsford.
"And the place has a reputation, a bad one."
"Cannibals?" suggested Rainsford.
"Hardly. Even cannibals wouldn't live in such a godforsaken place. But it's gotten into sailor lore somehow. Didn't you notice that the crew's nerves seemed a bit jumpy today?"
"And they were a bit strange, now you mention it. Even Captain Nielsen."
"Yes. Even that tough-minded old Swede,
who'd go up to the devil himself and ask him for a light. Those fishy blue eyes held a look I never saw there before. All I could get out of him was, "This place has an evil name among seafaring men, sir." And then he said to me very gravely, "Don't you feel anything?" As if the air about us was actually poisonous. Now, you mustn't laugh when I tell you this. I did feel something like a sudden chill. There was no breeze. The sea was as flat as a plate glass window. We were drawing near the island then. What I felt was a mental chill, a sort of sudden dread.
"Pure imagination," said Rainsford. "One superstitious sailor can taint the whole ship's company with his fear."
"Maybe. But sometimes I think sailors have an extra sense that tells them when they are in danger. Sometimes I think evil is a tangible thing, with wavelengths, just as sound and light have. An evil place can, so to speak, broadcast vibrations of evil. Anyhow, I'm glad we're getting out of this zone. Well, I think I'll turn in now, Rainsford."
"I'm not sleepy," said Rainsford. "I'm going to smoke another pipe on the after deck."
"Good night, then, Rainsford. See you at breakfast."
"Right. Good night, Whitney."
There was no sound in the night as Rainsford sat there, but the muffled throb of the engine that drove the yacht swiftly through the darkness, and the swish and ripple of the wash of the propeller. Rainsford, reclining in a steamer chair, indolently puffed on his favorite briar. The sensuous drowsiness of the night was on him.
"It's so dark," he thought, "that I could sleep without closing my eyes. The night would be my eyelids."
An abrupt sound startled him. Off to the right, he heard it, and his ears, expert in such matters, could not be mistaken. Again he heard the sound, and again. Somewhere, off in the blackness, someone had fired a gun 3 times. Rainsford sprang up and moved quickly to the rail, mystified. He strained his eyes in the direction from which the reports had come, but it was like trying to see through a blanket. He leaped upon the rail and balanced himself there to get greater elevation. His pipe, striking a rope, was knocked from his mouth. He lunged for it. A short, hoarse cry came from his lips as he realized he had reached too far and had lost his balance. The cry was pinched off short as the blood-warm waters of the Caribbean Sea dosed over his head. He struggled up to the surface and tried to cry out, but the wash from the speeding yacht slapped him in the face, and the salt water in his open mouth made him gag and strangle. Desperately, he struck out with strong strokes after the receding lights of the yacht, but he stopped before he had swum 50 feet. A certain cool-headedness had come to him. It was not the first time he had been in a tight place. There was a chance that his cries could be heard by someone aboard the yacht, but that chance was slender and grew more slender as the yacht raced on. He wrestled himself out of his clothes and shouted with all his power. The lights of the yacht became faint and ever-vanishing fireflies. Then they were blotted out entirely by the night. Rainsford remembered the shots. They had come from the right, and doggedly he swam in that direction, swimming with slow, deliberate strokes, conserving his strength. For seemingly endless time he fought the sea. He began to count his strokes. He could do possibly 100 more, and then Rainsford heard a sound. It came out of the darkness, a high, screaming sound, the sound of an animal in an extremity of anguish and terror. He did not recognize the animal that made the sound. He did not try to. With fresh vitality, he swam toward the sound. He heard it again. Then it was cut short by another noise, crisp, staccato. "Pistol shot," muttered Rainsford, swimming on. 10 minutes of determined effort brought another sound to his ears, the most welcome he had ever heard. The muttering and growling of the sea breaking on a rocky shore. He was almost on the rocks before he saw them. On a night less calm, he would have been shattered against them. With his remaining strength, He dragged himself from the swirling waters. Jagged crags appeared to jut up into the opaqueness. He forced himself upward, hand over hand, gasping, his hands raw. He reached a flat place at the top. Dense jungle came down to the very edge of the cliffs. What perils that tangle of trees and underbrush might hold for him did not concern Rainsford just then. All he knew was that he was safe from his enemy, the sea, and that utter weariness was on him. He flung himself down at the jungle edge and tumbled headlong into the deepest sleep of his life. When he opened his eyes, he knew from the position of the sun that it was late in the afternoon. Sleep had given him new vigor. A sharp hunger was picking at him. He looked about him, almost cheerfully. "Where there are pistol shots, there are men. Where there are men, there is food," he thought. But what kind of men, he wondered, in so forbidding a place? An unbroken front of snarled and ragged jungle fringed the shore. He saw no sign of a trail through the closely knit web of weeds and trees. It was easier to go along the shore, and Rainsford floundered along by the water. Not far from where he landed, he stopped. Some wounded thing. By the evidence, a large animal had thrashed about in the underbrush. The jungle weeds were crushed down and the moss was lacerated. One patch of weeds was stained crimson. A small glittering object, not far away, caught Rainsford's eye, and he picked it up. It was an empty cartridge. "A 22," he remarked. "That's odd. It must have been a fairly large animal, too. The hunter had his nerve with him to tackle him with a light gun. It's clear that the brute put up a fight. I suppose the first three shots I heard was when the hunter flushed his quarry and wounded it. The last shot was when he trailed it here and finished it." He examined the ground closely and found what he had hoped to find, the print of hunting boots. They pointed along the cliff in the direction he had been going. Eagerly, he hurried along, now slipping on a rotten log or a loose stone, but making headway. Night was beginning to settle down on the island. Bleak darkness was blacking out the sea and jungle when Rainsford sighted the lights. He came upon them as he turned a crook in the coastline, and his first thoughts was that he had come upon a village, for there were many lights. But as he forged along, he saw to his great astonishment that all the lights were in one enormous building, a lofty structure, with pointed towers plunging upward into the gloom. His eyes made out the shadowy outlines of a palatial chateau. It was set on a high bluff, and on three sides of it, cliffs dived down to where the sea licked greedy lips in the shadows. Mirage, thought Rainsford, but it was no mirage, he found, when he opened the tall spiked iron gate. The stone steps were real enough. The massive door, with a leering gargoyle for a knocker, was real enough. Yet above it all hung an air of unreality. He lifted the knocker, and it creaked up stiffly, as if it had never before been used. He let it fall, and it startled him with its booming loudness. He thought he heard steps within. The door remained closed. Again Rainsford lifted the heavy knocker and let it fall. The door opened then, opened as suddenly as if it were on a spring, and Rainsford stood blinking in the river of a glaring gold light that poured out. The first thing Rainsford's eyes discerned was the largest man Rainsford had ever seen, a gigantic creature, solidly made and black-bearded to the waist. In his hand, the man held a long-barreled revolver, and he was pointing it straight at Rainsford's heart. Out of a snarl of beard, two small eyes regarded Rainsford. "Don't be alarmed," said Rainsford, with a smile which he hoped was disarming. "I'm no robber. I fell off a yacht. My name is Sanger Rainsford of New York City." The menacing look in the eyes did not change, the revolver pointing as rigidly as if the giant were a statue. He gave no sign that he understood Rainsford's words, or that he had even heard them. He was dressed in uniform, a black uniform trimmed with gray astrakhan. "I'm Sanger Rainsford of New York," Rainsford began again. "I fell off a yacht. I'm hungry." The man's only answer was to raise with his thumb the hammer of his revolver. Then Rainsford saw the man's free hand go to his forehead in a military salute, and he saw him click his heels together and stand at attention. Another man was coming down the broad marble steps, an erect, slender man in evening clothes. He advanced to Rainsford and held out his hand. In a cultivated voice, marked by a slight accent that gave it added precision and deliberateness, he said,
"It is a very great pleasure and honor to welcome Mr. Sanger Rainsford, the celebrated hunter, to my home."
Automatically, Rainsford shook the man's hand.
"I've read your books about hunting snow leopards in Tibet, you see," explained the man. "I am General Zaroff."
Rainsford's first impression was that the man was singularly handsome. His second was that there was an original, almost bizarre quality about the general's face. He was a tall man, past middle age, for his hair was a vivid white, but his thick eyebrows and pointed military mustache were as black as the night from which Rainsford had come. His eyes, too, were black and very bright. He had high cheekbones, a sharp-cut nose, a spare, dark face, the face of a man used to giving orders, the face of an aristocrat. Turning to the giant in uniform, the general made a sign. The giant put away his pistol, saluted, withdrew.
"Ivan is an incredibly strong fellow," remarked the general, "but he has the misfortune to be deaf and dumb. A simple fellow, but I'm afraid, like all his race, a bit of a savage."
"Is he Russian?"
"He is a Cossack," said the general, and his smile showed red lips and pointed teeth. "So am I." "Come," he said. "We shouldn't be chatting here. We can talk later. You must want clothes, food, rest. You shall have them. This is a most restful spot."
Ivan had reappeared, and the general spoke to him with lips that moved, but gave forth no sound.
"Follow Ivan, if you please, Mr. Rainsford," said the general. "I was about to have my dinner when you came. I'll wait for you. You'll find that my clothes will fit you, I think."
It was to a huge, beam-ceilinged bedroom, with a canopied bed big enough for six men, that Rainsford followed the silent giant. Ivan laid out an evening suit, and Rainsford, as he put it on, noticed that it came from a London tailor who ordinarily cut and sewed for none below the rank of duke. The dining room to which Ivan conducted him was in many ways remarkable. There was a medieval magnificence about it. It suggested a baronial hall of feudal times, with its oaken panels, its high ceiling, its vast refectory tables where 20 men could sit down to eat. About the hall were mounted heads of many animals, lions, tigers, elephants, moose, bears, larger or more perfect specimens Rainsford had never seen. At the great table the general was sitting, alone.
"You'll have a cocktail, Mr. Rainsford," he suggested.
The cocktail was surpassingly good, and, Rainsford noted, the table appointments were of the finest, the linen, the crystal, the silver, the china. They were eating borscht, the rich red soup with whipped cream, so dear to Russian palates. Half apologetically, General Zaroff said,
"We do our best to preserve the amenities of civilization here. Please forgive any lapses. We are well off the beaten track, you know. Do you think the champagne has suffered from its long ocean trip?"
"Not in the least," declared Rainsford. He was finding the general a most thoughtful and affable host, a true cosmopolite. But there was one small trait of the general's that made Rainsford uncomfortable. Whenever he looked up from his plate, he found the general studying him, appraising him narrowly.
"Perhaps," said General Zaroff, "you are surprised that I recognize your name. You see, I read all books on hunting, published in English, French, and Russian. I have but one passion in my life, Mr. Rainsford, and that is the hunt."
"You have some wonderful heads here," said Rainsford as he ate a particularly well-cooked filet mignon. "That Cape Buffalo was the largest I ever saw."
"Oh, that fellow. Yes, he was a monster."
"Did he charge you?"
"Hurled me against a tree," said the general. "Fractured my skull, but I got the brute."
"I've always thought," said Rainsford, "that the Cape Buffalo is the most dangerous of all big game." For a moment, the general did not reply. He was smiling his curious, red-lipped smile. Then he said slowly,
"No, you are wrong, sir. The Cape Buffalo is not the most dangerous big game."
He sipped his wine.
"Here, in my preserve on this island," he said in the same slow tone, "I hunt a more dangerous game."
Rainsford expressed his surprise. "Is there big game on this island?" The general nodded.
"The biggest."
"Really?"
"Oh, it isn't here naturally, of course. I have to stock the island."
"What have you imported, general?" Rainsford asked. "Tigers?" The general smiled.
"No," he said. "Hunting tigers ceased to interest me some years ago. I exhausted their possibilities, you see. No thrill left in tigers, no real danger. I live for danger, Mr. Rainsford."
The general took from his pocket a gold cigarette case and offered his guest a long black cigarette with a silver tip. It was perfumed and gave off a smell like incense.
"We will have some capital hunting, you and I," said the general. "I shall be most glad to have your society."
"But what game?" began Rainsford.
"I'll tell you," said the general. "You will be amused, I know. I think I may say in all modesty that I have done a rare thing. I have invented a new sensation. May I pour you another glass of port?"
"Thank you, general." The general filled both glasses and said,
"God makes some men poets. Some he makes kings, some beggars. Me, he made a hunter. My hand was made for the trigger, my father said. He was a very rich man with 250,000 acres in the Crimea. And he was an ardent sportsman. When I was only 5 years old, he gave me a little gun, specially made in Moscow for me to shoot sparrows with. When I shot some of his prize turkeys with it, he did not punish me. He complimented me on my marksmanship. I killed my first bear in the Caucasus when I was 10. My whole life has been one prolonged hunt. I went into the army, it was expected, of noblemen's sons, and for a time commanded a division of Cossack cavalry, but my real interest was always the hunt. I have hunted every kind of game in every land. It would be impossible for me to tell you how many animals I have killed."
The general puffed his cigarette.
"After the debacle in Russia, I left the country, for it was imprudent for an officer of the Tsar to stay there. Many noble Russians lost everything. I, luckily, had invested heavily in American securities. So I shall never have to open a tea room in Monte Carlo or drive a taxi in Paris. Naturally, I continued to hunt. Grizzlies in your Rockies, crocodiles in the Ganges, rhinoceroses in East Africa. It was in Africa that the Cape Buffalo hit me and laid me up for 6 months. As soon as I recovered, I started for the Amazon to hunt jaguars, for I had heard they were unusually cunning. They weren't," the Cossack sighed. "They were no match at all for a hunter with his wits about him and a high-powered rifle. I was bitterly disappointed. I was lying in my tent with a splitting headache one night when a terrible thought pushed its way into my mind. Hunting was beginning to bore me. And hunting, remember, had been my life. I have heard that in America, businessmen often go to pieces when they give up the business that has been their life."
"Yes, that's so," said Rainsford. The general smiled.
"I had no wish to go to pieces," he said. "I must do something. Now, mine is an analytical mind, Mr. Rainsford. Doubtless that
is why I enjoy the problems of the chase.
No doubt, General Zaroff.
So,
continued the general,
I asked myself why the hunt no longer fascinated me. You are much younger than I am, Mr. Rainsford, and have not hunted as much, but you perhaps can guess the answer.
What was it?
Simply this. Hunting had ceased to be what you call a sporting proposition. It had become too easy. I always got my quarry, always. There is no greater bore than perfection.
The general lit a fresh cigarette.
No animal had a chance with me any more. That is no boast, it is a mathematical certainty. The animal had nothing but its legs and its instinct. Instinct is no match for reason. When I thought of these, it was a tragic moment for me, I can tell you.
Rainsford leaned across the table, absorbed in what his host was saying.
It came to me as an inspiration, what I must do,
the general went on. And that was?
The general smiled, with a quiet smile of one who has faced an obstacle and surmounted it with success.
I had to invent a new animal to hunt, he said.
A new animal? You're joking.
Not at all, said the general. I never joke about hunting. I needed a new animal. I found one. So I bought this island, built this house, and here I do my hunting. The island is perfect for my purposes. There are jungles with a maze of traits in them, hills, swamps.
But the animal, General Zaroff.
Oh, said the general. It supplies me with the most exciting hunting in the world. No other hunting compares with it for an instant. Every day I hunt. And I never grow bored now, for I have a quarry with which I can match my wits.
Rainsford's bewilderment showed in his face.
I wanted the ideal animal to hunt, explained the general. So I said, what are the attributes of an ideal quarry? And the answer was, of course, it must have courage, cunning, and above all, it must be able to reason.
But no animal can reason, objected Rainsford.
My dear fellow, said the general, there is one that can.
But you don't mean, gasped Rainsford.
And why not?
I can't believe you are serious, General Zaroff. This is a grisly joke.
Why should I not be serious? I am speaking of hunting. Hunting? Great guns, General Zaroff, what you speak of is murder.
The general laughed with entire good nature. He regarded Rainsford quizzically.
I refuse to believe that so modern and civilized a young man as you seem to be harbor so romantic ideas about the value of human life. Surely your experiences in the war did not make me condone cold-blooded murder,
finished Rainsford stiffly. Laughter shook the general.
How extraordinarily droll you are,
he said.
One does not expect nowadays to find a young man of the educated class, even in America, with such a naive and, if I may say so, mid-Victorian point of view. It's like finding a snuffbox in a limousine. Ah, well, doubtless you had Puritan ancestors, so many Americans appear to have had. I'll wager you'll forget your notions when you go hunting with me. You've a genuine new thrill in store for you, Mr. Rainsford.
Thank you, I'm a hunter, not a murderer.
Dear me, said the general, quite unruffled. Again that unpleasant word. But I think I can show you that your scruples are quite ill-founded.
Yes?
Life